on iPlayer. Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is Radio 3. It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Jeremy Deller is a difficult artist to pin down. He's won the Turner Prize and represented Britain at the Venice Biennale, but you're just as likely to find his work on our streets as in a gallery. In 2016, marking the centenary of the Battle of the Somme, thousands of young men in World War I uniforms appeared unannounced in stations, shopping centres and towns across the UK. Each participant represented a soldier who died on the 1st of July, 1916. Jeremy called this work We're Here Because We're Here. 15 years earlier, he recreated the clash between striking miners and police officers in the Battle of Orgreave. He's toured a rusting car from a street bombing in Iraq around the USA, and in 2012, he created a life-sized inflatable version of Stonehenge, which you could bounce on. Jeremy, your choices of music today are suitably wide-ranging, sometimes unexpected, taking us on a journey with sounds from across the world. But starting with Beethoven, tell us why.
Well, I was asked to create a work to coincide with Beethoven's anniversary in 2020. It was a big year of celebration in Germany, and I was offered the opportunity to work with the Beethoven Orchestra in Bonn, which is an incredible opportunity to have and to work with musicians. And I started listening to Beethoven in a way I hadn't really listened to him before. And I had an idea for this orchestra to interact with a group of children, who maybe have never been in the company of an orchestra before. And I created a film basically around this interaction of these children with the orchestra. And this is the piece of music that they come into the recording studio to. And they walk in quite slowly, and they walk around the orchestra playing this. And then they start moving in different ways. They start picking each other up, throwing shapes and improvising to the sound. They all hold hands and they encircle the orchestra.
Thank you.
The Allegretto from Beethoven's Symphony No. 7 in A Major, Opus 92, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Kirill Petrenko. Two questions, Jeremy. First of all, how did the children react to hearing that?
The younger ones especially had never been in the presence of an orchestra, so they were quite overawed by it. And I wanted to make this work because I remember the first time I heard an orchestra play and I just couldn't believe the sound that was being made. And that was a school orchestra when I was about 10 or 11. And I knew a lot of the people in the orchestra, these horrible little boys, basically. And yet when they all sat down and played music, it sounded amazing. I couldn't understand how you could create that sound on these instruments because I was trying to learn the violin at the time and it was horrendous. It was torture for everybody. And so I was hoping to give them that experience, but to be very close. And at one point during the film, some of the players allowed the children to play, you know, the double bass and have a blow on something or whatever. And so that was a lovely moment. And then one little girl started conducting because I wanted that as well. I wanted to have that element of kind of a chaos of the children, the order of the orchestra and the tension between them.
OK, so the second question is, how did you react to getting into Beethoven, which until then was probably slightly foreign to you?
Well, it's interesting because I went through all the symphonies and most of them I knew, just because they're so famous, they're everywhere. But the seventh, for some reason, I didn't know, and so it was a revelation to hear that, and I wanted something that wasn't so well known, to me at least, but I just loved, I think it was the atmospherics of that opening and the uncertainty of it and the tension within it was something I felt I could work with and use.
Where did your art education begin, in childhood or later?
It began in childhood. It began by going to museums and art galleries. And my older sister played the cello, which is probably why I haven't chosen any cello music. She would play certain pieces a lot, repetitively. I tried, but I couldn't. I just didn't have the patience of the violin. I was more visual arts. But in terms of school, after the age of 10 or 11, I didn't get on with the art teacher for a number of reasons, and I was out of the class within a year, and I was ushered into the pottery class, which is basically where you went if you didn't get on with the art teacher. And that was it, really.
One of the early works, we're talking about 1997 now, was a piece called The Social History of the World, a kind of mind map, I suppose, linking acid house music to brass bands.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how you connected the two together.
This is a kind of major moment for me, was having an idea for a brass band to play acid house music. And I need to explain what that music is, I suspect, a little bit. It's a form of electronic dance music from the mid to late 80s, mainly made in Detroit and Chicago, which was kind of an underground music scene in America. And then it became massively popular in the UK. It became a phenomenon. There's an amazing quote by a French philosopher called Jacques Attali, and it's music is prophecy. And I think that's absolutely so true. I think sometimes music actually pushes history forward in terms of what it's saying, but also the technology it's using. And I really felt this about this moment in history with this music. It was very denigrated at the time because I had a drug culture that went with it, almost inevitably, and that made it sort of a media hysteria moment as well. But I think it showed young people the future or a possible future. But at the same time, these parties were happening in former industrial spaces. So you had the past and the future effectively meeting.
Later that year, you managed to persuade the band leader of the Williams Ferry Band in Stockport to play the music. Was he hard to convince, and did they find it difficult to get the hang of it?
Well, I was very nervous approaching a traditional brass band with what I felt was a quite risky idea. So I rang the manager, John, and I said, would you be interested in playing contemporary electronic music? And you rely in life on managers of bands, and if they want to do something, then you basically have to obey them. That's how it felt. And John said, yeah, we'll do it once and we'll see how it goes. So he took a risk. And I chose tracks, songs, which I thought that a brass band would be able to handle and would show the range of a brass band, because I knew that they're very adaptable, like steel bands. They can play from orchestral to pop and avant-garde. And so the track we're going to play is the first song they ever played live to an audience in Liverpool. And I think half the audience went to laugh at them. Because as we know, in Britain, we have quite a difficult relationship with certain aspects of our culture, and brass bands is one of them, I would say, and folk culture as well, especially 25 years ago. I think things have changed a bit. So I think the band were very worried. But actually, as soon as they started playing this number, you could tell immediately that people were impressed, the young people especially, who'd never really heard a brass band, because it's an incredible, powerful sound. And it was very loud, and you can almost feel the air pressure changing in the room because there's so much air going in and out of people and instruments. And so I was very nervous, but it was a moment of great relief for me to realise that actually this is going to be fine. We'll be right back.
Can You Dance?, originally written by DJ Farsteady and arranged by Rodney Newton and performed by the Williams Fairey Brass Band. I bet they enjoyed it, didn't they?
Oh, they absolutely enjoyed it, because at that time, a traditional audience for a brass band, which I went to a lot of brass band concerts, was quite old, if not elderly. This band was a top-rated band because it's very competitive. You know, the rating systems of brass band is like Premier League or something. And they were number one in Britain, and yet still at the front row, in the middle, as they were playing, there was a woman knitting. And there were people asleep.
Knitting faster and faster.
Well, just really happily, just knitting. And I thought, wow, that must be so dispiriting, because most of the players are quite young. You have to be quite fit to play some of those instruments, on the top of your game almost. And so when they did these concerts with this music, often they'd be playing to people their own age or younger even, who were going crazy, like screaming and shouting and dancing, and giving them a kiss, and there's people like climbing up the stage. I mean, it was like they got really out of hand, and I think it's because people were not expecting to enjoy it so much. And also there's a sort of ritualistic element when you see a lot of people in a uniform playing music at the same time. So it was an adventure, basically, working with them, and it really changed how I work.
In 2001, you staged a reenactment of the Battle of Orgreave, one of the violent clashes during the miners' strike between picketing miners and the police in Rotherham, South Yorkshire. The original confrontation happened on the 18th of June, 1984. So what made you want to revisit that particular event?
I witnessed the miners' strike on TV for a year, and that particular moment, that particular battle confrontation, to me, as someone who's interested in history, looked like something from 400 or 500 years ago. It didn't look like a contemporary event. It had all the makings of a battle from even Roman times, of like people being pursued by horses, dogs, and snatch squads and shield formations and so on. So I saw it more as an historical event immediately as it happened. For me, it was like something from a civil war, effectively.
You involved reenactment societies and real people from mining families, which is the important point, and policemen who'd been through those events in 84. Was it hard to convince them, or did they get quite caught up with the idea?
Well, it's a good question, because a third were people from the area and two-thirds were from the reenactment community. And so it was interesting, because I spent 2 years going up and down to Yorkshire, talking to people in Rotherham, Doncaster, Sheffield, just so they knew who I was. I didn't just turn up 2 weeks before and try and convince people. And they asked tough questions, but luckily I could answer them. But on the whole, they understood the idea. They liked the idea. They liked the idea it was going to be a film and people were going to see it. And they also, they saw the humour within it, which was important. It could have degenerated into like a comedy thing, like a Monty Python sketch almost. And they understood that, and they realised why it shouldn't do that.
And presumably the people that had been through this brought to it a greater degree of emotion than possibly the reenactment people.
Absolutely, and I think the reenactors were shocked at the emotional charge that former miners brought to it. And they'd never experienced that, because, of course, you're never going to fight with or alongside people from a battle from history, even the Second World War. It's not just not going to happen anymore. But I think they were quite intimidated by the miners, by the camaraderie of these men who basically hadn't seen each other for years and then assembled on the rehearsal day, and they were with all their mates.
That obviously required a good degree of collaboration, and that does also happen in choral singing, and that's our next music.
Yes, this is a piece of music I remember singing when I was at school. We used to do these concerts. I'll never forget it, because we had to sing it so many times, and I loved singing it, but listening back for this programme, I was listening to versions of it, and you cannot recreate the intensity of being within a choir.
Well, I think there's something when you're performing a piece of music that you get inside it, so the feeling is different anyway.
And where I was, standing in the middle of it, it was very dry and flat, but intense to hear it and to be inside it. A lot of classical music and brass bands and steel bands even are recorded with a lot of reverb. I know they were performed in these huge spaces, but if you're within a choir or with an orchestra or within a brass band, the sound is entirely different.
This is certainly a smooth version, because it's the famous 16 conducted by Harry Christophers, a small group of experts. Beatus Vir by Monteverdi.
Beatus Vir, Beatus Vir, Beatus Vir,
Beata's Fear by Monteverdi, performed by The 16, directed by Harry Christophers. You're listening to Private Passions on Radio 3 with me, Michael Barclay, and my guest, Jeremy Deller. Bats, Jeremy.
Yes.
That's what we're going to come to next, because bats you obsess about, really, don't you?
They've appeared and reappeared in my work a lot. I'm very fond of them, and I think that's just from watching nature documentaries, but also I feel they're quite demeaned as a mammal. And I think they're actually one of the most amazing creatures on the planet.
You did a project called Bats in Space in 2012 to try and help people understand the sounds bats make. Because, of course, they're ultrasonic, aren't they?
Yeah, we can't hear them, luckily, because if we could, they'd be deafening because they're so loud. But I love the sound of echolocation when you can tune into it.
How do you tune into them?
It's basically like a radio, effectively. It's a receiver. So they are modulated. They're probably slowed down.
Slow it down, please.
Because the frequency is too high for the human ear. And for me, it sounds like electronic jazz almost that they're making. Obviously, for them, it's so entirely different. They don't feel they're making music, but they're finding prey and also avoiding obstacles and so they don't crash into anything or anyone. And you can tell that they're hunting because the sounds get closer and closer to each other.
Let's hear some of them, because these ones featured on Björk's album, Biophilia Live, didn't they?
Yeah, I know her, I know Björk, but a friend of mine was editing this record, editing the film, and they needed something to go out on with the credits, and that whole album is about nature and love of nature. And he said, do you have any bat sounds by any chance? And I had lots and lots of recordings of bat sounds from Texas, from a cave. It's not as the bats leave, because that's just overwhelming, there's millions, but this is at the end of the evening when there's a few around hunting. So that's what this sound is from. It's from free-tailed bats in Texas.
Jeremy's Texas Bats, as heard on the Biophilia Live Björk album. But it's not only the sounds of bats that you love from the natural world, because there's another clip that you wanted us to hear, which I found extraordinary, actually, because it involves water, using water as a percussion instrument, doesn't
it? Yeah, there's ones with singing, and there's also ones that are purely percussive. And they're from all over the world. I think this one is from Vanuatu. And there seems to be a tradition there of this, and it's with just a group of people making these different sounds. In a way, maybe it's a clue of what the first music making was using the environment like this.
Well, here are the ladies from the Banks Islands, Vanuatu, drumming on water.
Thank you.
love the way they get a kind of bass drum sound for the first beat of the bar, you know.
Yeah.
Boom. So they actually differentiate the pitch.
Yeah.
Water Drumming by Women from the Banks Islands in Vanuatu, recorded by A.J. Hickling and shared on his YouTube channel, Evolving Rhythms. Drumming clearly is very important to you, Jeremy Deller, because you want to share a drum solo now by the German drummer, Jackie Liebeseit.
Yeah.
How did you come across him?
Well, he was in a band called Can, who are this incredible experimental rock band. If I was ever been able to be in a band, it was the band I'd love to be in, and I probably would love to be in Jackie, because he was a very famous jazz drummer, and then other members of the band all were very skilled in their own worlds of rock, but also in experimental music and classical music. Very infuriating band as well, because some of their music I find unlistenable, but I will persevere with them because I trust them. And he died a few years ago, and I was just looking up to see if there are any examples of drum solos, and I came across this, which is a very long drum solo. Apparently, I've been told it was because electricity had gone at a concert and he had to sort of improvise a drum solo for the audience. I don't know if that's true or not. It's a nice story. But what I love about this solo, and it goes through different phases.
We're going to hear a couple of minutes from the end, because
right.
It is 7 minutes long.
Yeah. It's just the interaction with the audience. You can tell the audience are absolutely going wild because of this drumming, and he's wearing them out, basically.
Jack Liebeseit, the drummer from Cannes, performing a drum solo in the 1970s. Do you find listening to music helps you while you work, or do you find you can't listen to it?
I can't really work and listen to people talking, but sometimes I try and listen to music to get to a different state of mind, to unlock something or to free my mind a little bit. So I do sometimes put on music and with a blank piece of paper just see what happens.
I mean, you won the Turner Prize in 2004, and I wonder how important that was in allowing you to let your imagination fly.
Well, winning prizes is quite important in our society. People really put a lot of store by it. So it's good to win prizes. It's even good to be nominated for the Turner Prize, and it's something that will always be mentioned because I'll always be asked about it, like here. So, which is good, because my work relies upon working with other people and people wanting to meet me or doors being opened. And actually winning that prize, the most important thing about winning that prize, doors were opened because of it, and people maybe had confidence that, oh, I'm working with this guy, he's won the Turner Prize, so it's going to be okay. You were anointed, effectively.
But are you also suspicious of it, of the anointing?
Of course, because as soon as, you know, it's the classic thing, isn't it? As soon as I won it, I started getting invited to art things I'd never knew even existed. Now I just think I need to be invited to things, because otherwise maybe I'll stop being visible because of where I am and my age. And all those things, it's quite strange actually, how you can feel insecure even though you have this huge profile.
In many ways, your art, it's not so much about you, but creating an event, bringing people together to take part in something. Mm. Let's talk a little bit about Stonehenge next and
yes.
The project called Sacrilege.
Well, that was an example of that. It was an inflatable scale model of Stonehenge, which you could bounce on. And it was made during the Olympic year. And I did it for a number of reasons, one of which was basically for people to enjoy our shared history in that structure and to be able to go on it and bounce on it and enjoy it and have fun on it. It's funny, it's absurd, it's stupid.
Did the Druids take part?
Well, weirdly, I was very worried about the Druids. because I just thought, they are going to be so angry about this. And I called it Sacrilege. So I got the criticism in with the name. I just thought I should call it that because someone's going to tell me it's Sacrilege. And I'm going to say, yes, it is. I took that title from an album, a remix of Can. So it came from a music source. But I actually thought druids would turn up with like huge swords and try and just slash it. I'm a very pessimistic person, clearly. And they loved it.
Did they bounce on it?
They did. And they then they asked, could we have it for our druid get-together in a forest the following year? And I would have loved for them to have had it, but technically it wasn't possible because you needed so much space around it. When they saw it especially, it's difficult not to like when you see it, when you see young people, children, grown-ups, grandparents bouncing around Stonehenge and enjoying it, and there's nothing really bad about it.
Vaughan Williams next.
Yes.
What brought you to this?
Well, this is related, actually, because I was making a film about a British artist called Bruce Lacey, who had this incredible career from the 1950s to the 2000s, predicting history, in a sense, and social change. And he had a very intense moment where he did a number of rituals with his wife then, Jill, around stone circles. Not Stonehenge, but a lot of lesser-known ones. They're kind of made up, effectively, like rituals often are, but they're very intense and very profound. And I needed music that was very intense, very English, mysterious and spectral almost, which I think this music is.
The Romanza, the third movement from Symphony in D by Vaughan Williams, performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. You represented Britain at the Venice Biennale in 2013. Did you enjoy putting that show together?
I did. A lot of it was about music. There's a room about David Bowie's tour in 1972 to 1974 of the UK. It was a steel band actually playing that piece of music by Vaughan Williams. And the accompaniment was ultra slow motion footage of birds of prey flying through the air and taking off and landing and so on. And that related to the show as well. So the show was about England, past, present and future.
William Morris, you featured too, hero of yours.
I love William Morris. There's a mural of William Morris throwing Roman Abramovich's yacht into the lagoon.
Lifting it out of the water.
Yeah, like a titan, because he is a giant. He's a cultural giant. He's immortal almost, because he would have been disgusted by Abramovich's yacht and the whole idea of oligarchy and greed and capitalism. And he was known for having these rages where he would pick up objects and throw them. He was never violent to people, but he'd get very frustrated. And he would have definitely have tried to pick up Abramovich's yacht and destroy it.
Maybe there's an element here of taking traditions and reinventing them, which inevitably takes you back to something that you admired from the past.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of my childhood and youth on family holidays. And the first thing we would do, and we always had holidays in the UK, never went abroad. You go into a little village or a town, you'd go to the church, which of course drove me mad as a child. I hate to say it, but it was quite boring walking around an empty church. But of course now, what do I do when I go to a village or anything? I just go straight to the church, and you never know what you'll find. You might find a little bit of medieval wall painting or a gargoyle or a green man somewhere or an interesting floor.
Even just a sensibility somehow.
Yeah.
There's something about churches, the atmosphere, like graveyards.
Yeah, and I'm not afraid of them.
Well, maybe you like churches too, because there are often lots of bats.
There are bats. But I like ruins as well. I like going to ruined monasteries. That's almost my favourite thing.
But this idea of reinventing something from the past very much informs the next music.
Yeah.
The Beatles.
The Beatles. Well, it's a cover version of the Beatles.
Exactly.
Made by a band from Palestine called Sabrine, who are a sort of folk rock band, and an artist called Michael Rakowitz made an exhibition about the Beatles playing their last ever concert in Palestine on the roof of a building. I mean, the last ever concert, of course, was in London on Savile Row, on a roof of the Apple building. And he made this fantasy that they actually came to Palestine to create world peace and by doing this concert. And so he got a local band to reinterpret the whole of the album, basically, the whole of the Let It Be album, and play the songs that were played on the roof. And this is Get Back. And in a way, what's interesting is I actually think this is a better version than the Beatles version. And it actually shows where the Beatles could have gone in looking at other cultures to get inspiration. They'd gone to India, obviously, but it just, for me, it shows what a potential future of the Beatles could have been if they'd have experimented a bit more.
Thank you. Get Back, originally, of course, by the Beatles, but reinterpreted by the Palestinian rock band Sabrine. And we're very grateful to you for bringing in a wonderful blue vinyl disc.
Yes. I don't think it's a very easy record to find, actually, unfortunately, because it's such a fantastic version, I think.
You love the idea not only of reinventing, but also mass music making. I mean, you mentioned steel bands too earlier. Yeah.
For me, the orchestra, the choir, the band like that shows sort of humanity at its best. You know, you have all these people that come together and they all have their problems and faults or whatever, and yet they can pick up an instrument and then play something incredibly beautiful. And then in a way, that's a metaphor, a hopeful metaphor for mankind and womankind.
Because they have to listen to one another.
Yes, cooperate with each other to create something of great beauty.
Jeremy Deller, perhaps one of your most moving works of art was We're Here Because We're Here, the piece to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the first day of the Somme, where over 19,000 men were killed.
It was the greatest disaster in British military history, because they were killed on one day, and probably within the space of about 3 hours. And I was asked to think of what could happen. What could you do to commemorate a disaster? I thought that it should be a memorial for one day, because it was a one-day event, effectively, that went through the whole of Britain, wasn't just in one city. Like a traditional war memorial is an immovable object that you go to and you have a certain sort of feeling when you're there, and then you leave and you get on with your day. And I wanted something that actually intervened. It was almost a viral artwork through the body of the country, and so intervened in your daily life, got in the way as you're going to work, or you saw it at the corner of your eye from a bus or a train. So it was maybe up to 2,000 participants who were in full uniform, most of them very young, because that was the ages of people who had been killed. And they were just hanging out in Britain, throughout the whole of Britain. They started at stations and then got on trains, walked up to Snowdon, some of them did. Others were just hanging around in shopping centres and overpasses, underpasses, bridges, roundabouts.
And they concluded by taking the tune of Auld Lang Syne to sing We're Here Because We're Here.
Yes, this was sung by the troops at the time in the trenches probably, or when they were marching. You say, we're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. And it just goes on and on. So it's this pointless sing-along. And strangely, that work was much loved by right-wing press and people on the right, and also left-wing press and people on the left. So people took from it what they wanted. So I was very happy about that, but it sort of transcended politics.
I've loved your description of art as being a way of staying in love with the world.
Yeah.
Do you think that was how you came to some of your conceptual ideas, that actually you wanted to find a way to deal with what you perceived around you?
Yes, definitely. And I think music is also a way of staying in love with the world and with people. But definitely, because some of the things I work with are actually very complicated events or tragic events.
Harrowing, like, even.
Yes. So you mentioned the car we towed around the US, which had been involved in a bomb attack. And then the First World War, the miners' strike. So I often make work about things that I'm attracted to, but also things that I'm not attracted to or I don't like. You know, the idea of, obviously, of warfare and of strife. These are difficult things, but I think for me it's a way of dealing with it through art.
Sadly, we've come to the final piece. What is it?
Well, this is a traditional folk song called Constant Billy, but it's been played on non-traditional folk instruments. It's electronic music. And I did a talk recently and I got Boss Morris, who are this female Morris side, to come and dance. They dress incredibly, and it's like glam rock almost, and they perform to this music. And I really love the idea of taking a folk tradition and updating it. And that's what this does. And it's a lovely tune. And of course, folk tunes are always great tunes because they've stood the test of time.
Well, Jeremy Deller, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
Constant Billy by Aubrey Common featuring Boss Morris. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the artist Jeremy Deller. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael will be talking to the Grammy Award-winning folk artist Rhiannon Giddens. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds, and on your smart speaker. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. Rishi Sunak has met the Chinese Premier Li Qiang to express significant concerns about Beijing's interference with the UK's democracy. The matter was raised after it emerged that a parliamentary researcher was arrested on suspicion of spying for China, alongside another man accused of breaching the Official Secrets Act. Both have since been released on bail. The Moroccan army has cleared a main road to one of the areas worst affected by Friday's earthquake after it was blocked by a landslide. The government says troops and rescue teams are helping rural communities in the Atlas Mountains, but efforts are being hampered by blockages on small roads. At least 2,000 people are known to have died, while 2,000 have been injured. Around 40 inmates have been moved from Wandsworth Prison as an investigation takes place into how the terror suspect Daniel Khalif escaped. The Justice Secretary, Alex Chalk, says the correct security measures and staffing levels were in place when the former soldier absconded. The Trades Union Congress will report the government to the United Nations watchdog on workers' rights about the proposed Strike Act. The legislation would see employees compelled to provide a minimum level of service during industrial action, which the TUC has called unworkable. The government says the measure would protect lives and livelihoods. A Spanish voluntary aid worker has been killed in Ukraine after a vehicle she was travelling in was hit by a projectile. Spain's foreign minister says she was in the country as part of humanitarian efforts. At least 40 people have died in airstrikes by the Sudanese military on a market in the south of the country's capital, Khartoum. A local resistance group has said that the market was used to organise pro-democracy protests. More than 7,000 people have been killed since April in a conflict between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. The US President Joe Biden's arrived in Vietnam to sign an agreement aimed at improving the two countries' diplomatic relations. The deal's expected to focus on the supply of rare earth minerals and the manufacture of semiconductors. The four-time Olympic champion runner Simone Farah has completed his final competitive race. He finished the half-marathon Great North Run in fourth place. And the weather very warm for the rest of the day with scattered thundery and heavy showers for most. Longer spells of rain around Wales, central and northern England. Tonight, eastern and southern England will become dry and clear. BBC News, it's 2 minutes past one.
Every weekday morning, BBC Radio 3 brings you the finest classical music. From old favourites to new discoveries. And the Daily Playlister, chosen by you. Essential Classics with me, Georgia.